exhibition number 16444, Rear 1.
Mr. Mallander, Rear 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Coolsden in Surrey.
Which year was this?
1919.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a bus operator in London until, I think it was about 1933, when the London Passenger Transport Board was formed, and they took over his 86 buses to integrate into the big system. And then he started to operate motor coaches down from London to Southend, right the way through the heart of Essex.
What about your schooling?
Schooling, I was at preparatory school at Caterham and went on to Ottershaw College, which is a young public school in 1932. Ottershaw was near Chertsey in Surrey. And from there, I went on to, through University of London, to Cambridge University, reading engineering. I went up in 1938.
I think that was St John's College.
That's St John's College, that's right.
Did you do any flying at Cambridge?
Yes, I did. I joined up in the University Air Squadron just as soon as I could, where we were. We flew from Duxford initially on Avro Tutors, a lovely old biplane, and then you got the occasional flight in a Hawker Hart. You had those as the sort of more advanced you were, the better chance you got of getting a flight in a big aeroplane.
Why were you interested in flying in the first place?
Well, I told you I was born at Coolsden. In actual fact, that was a part of Coolsden, is a place called Kenley, where, of course, is a very, very famous wartime aerodrome. Well, because that aerodrome was there, I used to bicycle past it on my way to school and used to stop and watch lovely old aeroplanes like Sidley Siskins and Gloucester Gamecocks and things like that disporting themselves on this little airfield. And I was mad keen on aeroplanes from that date, probably even beforehand. I think an aeroplane crashed on the house next door to us. And unfortunately, both the crew were killed. But I wondered at the time, well, why did they do that? Why didn't they pick the field next door to us?
Did you have any problems in learning how to fly?
Only that I was fairly slow. I think I was pretty slow. In fact, I know I was slow. Although I went up to RAF College Service Flying Training School at Cranwell with a license, a civil license, and had been flying with the University Air Squadron, they tried to scrub me off the service flying course that I was on, once again, on Harts, that my instructor decided he didn't want to solo me. And I never quite worked out why, and my flight commander took me up and said, look, this is a scrub test. Call me Peter, in actual fact. So I said, yes, sir, I don't quite know what I'm doing wrong. He said, well, what does your flying instructor tell you? He said, well, I can't hear what he says. He's always shouting at me. And that's where I learnt probably a lot about flying instructing, is to talk very, very clearly and very precisely to your student. And at the end of my course on these lovely Harts and Hinds at Cranwell, they posted me straight down to Upavon, which was the central flying school at the time, on an instructor's course. And I suffered the first 3.5 years of the war teaching young hopefuls to fly. First on Tiger Moths, first on Miles Masters, then a short spell on Tiger Moths Elementary Flying School in Rhodesia, and then a long spell on Airspeed Oxfords, which I must admit I did enjoy in the end. Once I'd made up my mind that I was going to be a flying instructor and there was no way of getting off it, I think most of us wanted to, of course, fly Spitfires and Hurricanes and things, and to be, you know, we felt that it was rather infra-dig to be a flying instructor. although, of course, probably saved my life later on because I knew how to fly when I got on to operations.
At what stage did you realise that a war was coming?
Well, I think fairly intelligent people thought the war was coming when, as soon as Neville Chamberlain came back and said, I have a piece of paper, there will be peace in our time. And everybody said, the peace won't be in our time, we shall have war in our time, most of us. And certainly anybody that had anything to do with flying service aircraft. And don't forget that I knew them at that time. The Air Force people were training us.
And what was your reaction when Chamberlain made his declaration of war in September 39?
Well, I was at home at the time. It was in the middle of a long vacation. I'd been rowing at Henley, and then it was about time to go, if you recall, that's September the 3rd, it was very nearly time to go back to university for the next year. And instead of going to university, of course, we went to the initial training wing, which was at Cambridge.
Did you have any political attitude towards the German regime and the declaration of war?
At Ottershaw, we had quite a number of, what's the correct term, escapees from Nazism. A few Jews, a pair of boys there called Trevor Arnus, they were sons of the Minister of Transport out in there, and he sent his children away from Germany to be educated in at Ottershaw. There was another chap called Valentine, or Valentin, D-I-N, no E on the end there. I believe he became a U-boat commander later on in the war. Or rather, in the war, because I'm now talking about 1932, 33 and 34, when these lads were, you know, had been eased out of Germany. We got on quite well with them. You know, they were, we didn't have those sort of anti-Jewish feeling in school, among schoolboys, I don't think. A lot of these chaps were Jewish.
Now, when you became an instructor, it was about the time of the Battle of Britain, I think.
Yes, it was.
Was there much pressure on you to push people through the courses?
I think we would have resisted it anyway, but yes, the courses were shortened. And I was part of, you know, we took part in the shortened course. And when you think about it, we went through a hurried course ourselves through Cranwell. The war course, I was on number 8 war course. I got there in March and left there in June. Now, that was a course that would have taken at least 2 years for a cadet before the war. It was rushed, all right. But we didn't feel that we were in any way shorted. We packed an awful lot of flying into those times. I incidentally I've got a logbook of that period. Still, the very first Air Force logbook. So you can see that for yourself later.
What were the main problems in instructing pilots in 1940?
It was the interchange from biplane flying to monoplane and retractable undercarriage and variable pitch airscrews, because none of those I had met before I went to Central Flying School. I was trained at Cranwell, still on biplanes, you see. Admittedly, it was the last lot of... I was on the last course that had biplanes to learn on at Cranwell. And then they went on to Harvard's and Oxford's.
Did the German Air Force attack any of the places you were
Yes, we were bombed at Cranwell. One stick of bombs, the only thing I can remember, is that was one air raid. Though it was raided quite once or twice whilst I was there. But they didn't do any much damage. There was one quite big bomb dropped at the flying control tower, which was reported to have moved it back a little bit, but it didn't do any damage, really. Windows broken, no structural damage.
At Cranwell?
Yes.
Why do you think the raid was such a failure?
Well, a raid, a bombing raid, as I knew only too well afterwards, was when you'd either started a dirty great big fire, or there was structural damage. That there was no structural damage to the airfield. There were a few holes. You know, we got remarkably quick at filling in bomb holes on airfields, and there were no runways at Cranwell, as you know, it was a great big grass airfield with one very smooth strip down the middle, which was made for that record-breaking flight with a big fairy aeroplane, single-engine thing. It flew all the way from Cranwell to Walvis Bay. They hoped to get to Cape Town non-stop with it. If you recall, no, you might have heard about it in your researches.
Which month was this raid that the Germans made?
Which
month was it?
Ooh.
June?
I should have said late April. Late April or May, early May.
Any other raids by the German Air Force that you experienced personally?
Only going through London on posting. That's when the real London Blitz had started. And that was, of course, when I was posted out in late September, October, to go to southern Rhodesia, because London was taking a good beating up then. I was at Uxbridge, at the reception centre there, when Becton Gas Works was hit. And that was a bit shattering for us, because you could see it right the way across London. You could actually see the burning, the glow from Uxbridge right the way across the heart of London to Becton.
That was during the London Blitz, was it?
Yes, it was the early part of the London Blitz, yes. I don't know when they did say that the London Blitz started. You'll have to tell me that. But I can't recall. All I know is that it was, getting fairly hot at that time.
I think they usually say September 1940. Yes. Now, can you tell me about how and why you were posted to Southern Rhodesia, please?
Rhodesia Air Training Group was formed. We were 21 SFTS, and we took and formed it out there. It was the, I think I'm right in saying, the first Oxford, first station equipped with Oxfords in that group. It's now called Harare. Salisbury used to have, that had the first one, they had Harvards there. There were two elementary flying training schools. There was Guineafowl and Induna. They were both equipped with Tiger Moths. And we came along there with Oxfords. And then another station was formed at Thornhill for teaching navigators and bomb aimers, and they were equipped with Ansons.
Was Southern Rhodesia a good place to do flying instruction?
Absolutely wonderful. It turned out nice again every day. The bad weather was restricted to a very, very short period, and usually at the end of a busy day anyway, when the weather broke. It was a superb place to teach flying, but whether it was good experience for flying when you got back to the bad weather in Europe, I don't know. This you'll have to ask the experts. We thought it was a good idea because it gives a chap confidence, and you can always give him air experience when he's learnt to fly in this country, which was the same for myself when I came back. I was sent through an advanced training school course to acclimatise, and also went through an operational training unit on Wellington's. It was Oxford's first to acclimatise us, and then Wellington's, as an operational training unit course, and then I went conversant onto mosquitoes. And that's how I got through to that stage.
And what was the attitude of the population in Rhodesia towards the war?
A bit bitter, because we used to start flying at 5:30 in the morning, and we were right on the edge of Bulawayo. They didn't like it a lot, but I think they were awfully good to us. Awfully good to us. They really were. We had a lovely time. They always welcomed you in their homes any time. And I made some very good friends out there. But there was no antipathy, no, don't think that. And we got on very, very well with them. But naturally, they could not understand why we had to work so early. You had to work early, because especially in the summer, because the weather got so full of thermals that you couldn't really teach flying from 11:30 till evening time. It was too bumpy. And don't forget that a lot of Rhodesia is above 4,500 feet, and that sort of takeoff performance of the Airspeed Oxford wasn't all that good at that height, and it got very much worse as the temperature went up, you see. It's not they didn't have this trouble with the Harvards, because they were more powerful, supercharged as well.
Did you train any particularly well-known people?
I don't know if you knew a man called Brian Inglis, do you? He was one of my students. He just died. He's just died, unfortunately. Great man, and I liked him.
He used to be a television.
Yes, that's right. A very quiet man, he's serious. Took his flying terribly seriously. An easy man to teach to fly, of course, because he just listened. Went in, stayed there. It's just a great advantage if you're trying to learn to fly, if you can remember what the chap says. Nobody that you would know as called particularly well known.
Did you have any problems in doing the job there?
None at all, no. As I say, having made up my mind to be a flying instructor, I think I became quite a good one, because I studied it. I got interested in teaching people to fly, and I went on doing it after the war. As soon as the war stopped, I rejoined the Volunteer Reserve and was flying, teaching young hopefuls to fly air cadets at Hornchurch in Essex, and then when I went up to Norfolk, left my brother to run the engineering in Essex, I went up to Norfolk to boat build, and then got invited to assist in the flying instructing at Norfolk Norwich Aero Club at Swanton Morley. So I was back in flying instructing again.
Why did you leave flying training in southern Rhodesia in October of 1943?
I'd done my tour. That was a 3-year tour of instructing. And, of course, we had our applications in for posting since the first week we were there to try and get back onto operations, which everybody wanted to do.
Why was everybody keen to get onto operations?
Excitement more than anything else. I don't think it was particularly brave. It's just that everybody wanted to do it. you can talk to very, very few people wanted only to be flying instructors. If you flew aeroplanes, you wanted to fly them operationally, I think.
Can you describe the process between Rhodesia and actually getting onto a squadron, please?
How was it done? They were divided into two or three groups, ones that were going to become bomber pilots, assessed as being, you know, good for that job, were sent home to operational training units. Those that were going to go on to coastal command and reconnaissance work, they went down to South Africa to a place called George, where they were taught the ins and outs of more thorough navigation than a bomber command pilot would need. And that is really about all of our people, because, you see, we hadn't got fighter aircraft. There was no potential there. And very, very few young pilots, shall I say, got onto night fighters. You'd had to have done something else to get onto night fighters. We all wanted to get back on. When I came back home, the first thing I applied for was to be a night fighter pilot. Because I realised it was too old. Everybody, you see, 25 years old, you were considered much too old to fly Spitz and Hurricanes. Unless you'd been doing it for a long time. So night fighters, it was an opportunity, but they had a crafty way. They used to send you for night vision tests, and the girls there were told that everybody's average this week because we don't need any we don't need any more night fighter pilots. So although I have extremely good night vision, I was assessed by those people at Harrogate in the panel as average. But I knew, I fell in immediately to what the trick was. Because they would never admit it. I don't think you would ever get anybody to admit that.
And the next stage?
To get onto operations, for students, they would, as I say, well, they'd go through operational training on Wellington, usually for Bomber Command, and then onto operational conversion. That means if they were going to fly Halifaxes, they would be sent to a conversion unit, which trained them onto Halifaxes, Stirlings, or Lancasters, you see, and then posted to squadrons, where usually they started off as second pilots. Co-pilots, if you like to use the term. We call them second pilots. Until they'd learnt enough about flying and bombing to get into the left-hand seat to become captain of the aircraft. And that's how they... That's the system. Then you were at work.
Where did you go to yourself?
I went to OTU at Westcott and Oakley. There were two airfields, one day flying, one night flying. Oakley was that night flying only. And from there I went to a 1655 flight at War Boys and then Witten for navigational work. Having crewed up with your navigator, we were then posted to Witten, where we do long-distance training. And then they sent me to 5 Group. Then I had an interview with, I don't know whether this ought to be on now, I had an interview I was sent for by the Pathfinder man himself, Don Bennett. And he said, I don't know what they've sent you here for, Mallander. I can't see any use for a tired instructor in my group at all, so I'm going to send you to 5 Group, where I understand that they have got some funny ideas about target marking. And that is how I finished up the 627 Squadron. Just like that.
Did he say tired instructor or tired. Retired instructor?
He said tired instructors. You see, we'd done 3 years, three and a bit years flying instructing, and he couldn't see how we were ever going to make good mosquito pilots. There was a theory at the time that that ex-instructors always got themselves killed because they flew too straight and level, because there's a lot of tosh. I think accurate flying was very, very useful in my work as a marker pilot with 627 Squadron. Because we had to get, we were allowed, I think it was a 2 minute error in 600 miles, which is means fairly close flying when you think about it. It's better than British Railways was this morning for you.
What kind of impression did Don Bennett make on you?
I didn't like it. It was another one of these bombastic blokes who was too big for his boots altogether. I saw no necessity for him to be rude to me at all. I'd never been rude to him. I couldn't understand why he should be rude to me. But there you are. You met chaps like that in the Air Force. You met the opposite. Every now and again you met very famous officers who were so polite it was, well, it made you feel really good. Sir Ralph Cochrane was one of them. He was my boss, the AOC&C of 5 Group. And he handed over to a man called Constantine, another charming man, a man you could talk to if you had problems, if you had any bright ideas. Ring him up, talk to him. He was just like that. They were great men. But this man, Bennett, he just struck sparks. I couldn't have worked with him anyway. I mean, I could see that. I mean, I should have been hurled out on my neck, you know, within days.
How did flying the Wellington compare with flying the Mosquito?
Well, there's a difference between a lorry and a sports car. Just like that. The Wellington, even the Mark 10s with the Hercules engines, were a lumbering great big thing compared to the really lively Mosquito.
You were telling me earlier about the work that the navigator in a Mosquito had to do when coordinating with his pilot. Can you repeat what you were telling me about the special things that he had to do in the aircraft?
Well, other than the fact that he had very little room, I did explain to you that the navigator was sitting to your right and slightly behind you, just a little bit behind you. He had to work with his chart board on his lap. His G-set, the scope, was just about the position behind you, behind the pilot's head, and over the navigator's left shoulder. It was a difficult. It was difficult to see carefully, but they coped extraordinarily well. These navigators were. They got extremely good, very, very quick. I think nearly all of them were second tour men and sometimes third. Mine was certainly second. He had done a tour on Wellington's before he asked to be posted to Mosquitoes. And actually, I'm proud to say that John Gaunt picked me. They said, well, here you are, navigators and pilots, crew up. And John came up and said, well, will you take me as your navigator? And I said, be delighted. And I found out afterward why. One of our jobs on Mosquito Train, anybody who could fly on Oxford, used to fly the navigators round on cross-country exercises.